This is Game Theory, our podcast about competition, strategy, and decision-making, hosted by me, Nick Andrews, and my brother Chris. In this episode, why the videos are muted. The first line of Taylor Swift's mega-hit Anti-Hero goes, quote, "I have this thing where I get older, but just never wiser." TikTokers around the world use the first bit of this line, "I have this thing," to make fun of themselves and poke fun at aspects of their lives and their personalities, like their pets and their mental health disorders. It's an example of how content creators have been using music to create their content. Now, however, Taylor Swift's entire catalog has been removed from the platform, along with hundreds of artists like Drake, Adele, and Post Malone. This is because the company that owns the distribution rights, Universal Music Group, failed to strike a deal with TikTok to license the music. On one side, TikTok wants to keep a hard bottom line, and on the other side, Universal Music Group wants to make as much money as possible while protecting its artists from the creeping arm of artificially created content. Caught in the crossfire are the budding artists using the platform to promote themselves. And welcome to episode 104 of Game Theory Podcast about competition strategy, decision making. Chris, there's a bookshelf behind you and it has many times had books on it. It no longer has books on it.
Yeah, you can see a few remaining tchotchkes and knickknacks, but we are in the process of what is arguably the worst experience a human being can endure, which is moving from one location to another location in the same vicinity.
I will say this.
It's the worst thing. I hate doing this.
I have moved a number of times.
As many people have moved a number of times.
I have never managed to move not during sweaty season. And as a bigger gentleman, congratulations. You really, that is helpful.
Yeah. As someone born of girth and raised of girth and continue to live his adult life of girth, it's nice being able to do it when it's cool and breezy outside as opposed to a million degrees. We also have an advantage of having really great moving infrastructure because it turns out there are a lot of people who just want to get the hell out of this place.
Yeah.
So there's really great companies and resources available to people who want to do that. And we're in the middle of that process right now. And if I could wave my magic wand and put all of our stuff into boxes, I would. As it happens, I get told what stuff to put into boxes. So it's like someone else is waving a magic wand. And I am the magic,
yeah,
in a sense.
So, first of all, shouts to those companies for existing. Every time they show up, I'm like, oh, man, this is, I'm so happy about capitalism right now. This is so nice. Just do it for me, please.
Absolutely. So amazing.
Secondly.
That's fantastic.
It's like a six-week period of horrible stuff. Like, living, you're just like, I don't like where I live, and I don't live where I'm going to live, and I hate it. You're stuck.
Yeah, that's exactly how I feel right now. And also, man, where did I get all this crap?
Dude, that
just the purging, so much stuff.
The best part of moving is the purge. Like when you're like, nope, garbage, burn it, I don't care. Look, let's donate it. Like, I don't give a shit as long as it's not in here. I don't care. I don't care.
These little free libraries that are kind of dotted around the area are going to get a huge influx of a bunch of stupid stuff that I can't believe I held on to. Yeah, and then once we get to the new place, once we move all our bookshelves and put all the books up, first of all, the books are my main expression of personality. I think it's a very DC thing. A lot of people think, oh, well, how do I demonstrate how learned and quirky I am? Well, it's by putting books everywhere. Don't ask me how many of those books I've read because the number is frighteningly small, vanishingly small, in fact. But I'm going to be shocked, I know, on the other end when we get to the new location to realize how many crappy books I still have. And I'll be shocked that like I didn't get rid of them in the purge, and so I'll have like a little mini purge 2.0. So I'm looking forward to that, but there's a lot of time between now and then.
Yeah,
a lot of space in that gulf.
I think I'm with you on like the amount of books you have. So we got this bookshelf behind me when we moved in, and now there's so much space for activities on the bookshelf. I'm like, wow, we were out of the bookshelf we had actually had too many books. It was not, it didn't work anymore. Now that we've got this thing, I'm like, I could double the amount of books I have. Like, I just got to go to Barnes & Noble real quick and just buy some more books that I'm not going to read.
Well, the key to adulthood, it's like when you get a room that's big enough to put your bed in the middle, like not in the corner.
Mm-hmm.
That's a sign of real adulthood. Or like when you have a couch that's not up against a wall in a room. You've got it kind of in the middle of the room where there's space to walk behind it. That's a sign of when you've kind of grown up past being like a young adult or a bachelor or something. Your next phase with the bookshelves is finding little tchotchkes and decorative items and maybe a picture or two to artfully display the books on your bookcase. Because now it's not enough to just have a bunch of books, because everybody is like, okay, you know, we're all on equal ground. Nobody has read the books that are actually in their home. So now the question is, how do I make these books look good? You could be a psychopath and turn them all around backwards so that you only see like the white facing, like the pages.
That do that, that's psychotic. God, stop that.
The only place that that's acceptable to do really is in like the display floor at IKEA, where they have those like Swedish books that,
or like the common kind of area like of around. An apartment complex. That's a good spot for it.
I guess. Because I mean, unless it's like an impressive library, nobody's going down there to like read books. So that's okay. That's fine. But those places are meant to be devoid of personality.
Exactly.
And if it's like that in your home, please stop.
They are busy as far as decorations go, but I like them. I like books and other things. I do got to find the tchotchkes, as you're calling them. That's the next step for decorating this room, which is I've been refined to a
corner. Is that orange thing up there?
What is that?
If you can see, if you're watching on YouTube, that's like a Disney thing. Oh. I don't know. It's like an orange with a face.
Oh.
And then this guy right here, that's just a tiki guy. I like him a lot too.
Tiki.
Yeah,
tiki
just Tom? A tiki.
All right.
Tiki Tom. Got a hat there. We got this Valentine's Day bird chef thing that they sell at Target. We got a ton of those birds.
There's a lot of birds.
It's like we got the Target aviary just populating our home here. So we got like I swear we have a whole box just nothing but seasonal decorative birds in cute outfits. It's like every Target mom's dream.
So I love tchotchkes. Big fan of tchotchkes. And so I'm trying to find more tchotchkes.
Tchotchke guy.
And I'm gonna tchotchke it up. But before I tchotchke it up, we've got to talk about today. We're talking about licensing agreements and various negotiations between how things work. And I want to segue into this because this is not the topic, but it is adjacent, sort of. I saw a TikTok and an analysis by a film nerd. I don't think this person does anything in the film industry specifically. He has a theory regarding comic books to the big screen that I think is hilarious. And I want to get your take on it because this is be something that is a little bit more up your alley than mine. His theory is that, so I didn't know this. You had to explain this to me years ago when you're like, well, what's your favorite Marvel movie? And I was like, Venom. And you're like, well, that's a Marvel comic, but it's in a different thing. And I was like, shut up. There are two Marvels. And you're like, yeah, one of them is produced by the Asian company Sony. And it filmed here in the United States. It is not the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's the like Marvel comic universe. And it is not the same thing as Iron Man and Thor and all of those people. It's kind of a different thing. So here's the theory. This guy's theory is that Sony is leading its actors on to think that they're going to be in the Marvel Cinematic Universe when they're doing a Marvel film, but in reality, they're in the Sony universe, and there are a number of reasons. He cites first Dakota Johnson and Sydney Sweeney, who are playing, I think, Madam Web. They're in Madam Web.
They're in Madam Web. I don't know who they're playing. I don't really intend on watching that one.
Yeah, I don't either. But Sydney, it will do really well. Sydney Sweeney is like the hottest actress in the world right now in terms of like popularity and money and things. So Dakota Johnson found out, she tagged in a post Marvel Studios, and everyone's like, ooh, no, that's not what's happening here. And then she fired her agent.
Oh, no, that's really awkward.
That is really awkward. Not the only one. There was a rapper, I think, is it 21 Savage? I forget. It was someone was cast in another Sony thing, and he said he was super excited to be in the MCU. He then dropped out of the project about a month later. And then the guy that plays young Prince Philip in The Crown, don't know his name, said he asked one of his friends in the Marvel Cinematic Universe what it was like to do a Marvel movie, and he is actually in the Sony universe. So this guy's like connecting dots and be like, I think Sony's pitch to actors is like, oh yeah, come do a Marvel film. Not a lie. It's not a lie.
Well, there's some complex dynamics underlying this that have nothing to do with storytelling and nothing to do with like the cohesion of the Marvel Cinematic Universe or whatever.
What a perfect segue.
I think we're at a phase now that's really passé. Mm-hmm. And you know, liking Marvel's not cool, mostly because all the recent stuff just kind of sucks. one of the big draws that they had for a little while there was that they were able to do this multiverse thing. They're still kind of going in that vein, but the thrill of it is, for years, different properties in Marvel were owned, like the creative rights to like the characters and the storylines and stuff. They were owned by different companies. So right. Like for a long time, I think it was like Fox owned the X-Men. And yeah, that Fox produced right. like the X-Men movies like that have like Sir Ian McKellen. Yeah, right. I think the first one actually did come out in 2000.
Great. So, I'm an X-Men guy. That was my comic. It serves comics to screen, X-Men and Watchmen for me.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that was, so Watchmen, of course, being the DC universe, that was a little bit more of a one-off story. Yeah. But the point is that a different studio owned Fox than owns Marvel Cinematic Universe, because that's a Disney thing now. And you know, those property rights are kind of changing and going back and forth depending on negotiations. And there's not really a clear delineation all the time. Like the X-Men is one thing, but then Spider-Man is kind of owned by Sony. But obviously he's appeared in Marvel Cinematic Universe stories. The first being Civil War, Captain America film. And then later on, he was brought in for his own projects and they've used the character extensively in like the Avengers films and stuff. And as these big studios trade with each other with right regard to like the rights to the characters that appear in the different movies and shows change over time. And one of the things with this multiverse storyline is that now they can say, oh, well, there are all these different versions of these characters that are out there. And so you remember those old Spider-Man movies with Tobey Maguire and then the other less old Spider-Man movies with Andrew Garfield? Turns out they're all the same Spider-Man, but they're just different versions in different universes. And so the company that owns the rights to all these Spider-Man guys, which is Sony, can then make a deal with the Disney-owned version, and they can put these different versions of the same character with the same name and all the copyrights and stuff. They can put them in the same movies. And so there's this like linkage now between the universes, and like Spider-Man is kind of at the center of it because he's just such an insanely popular character.
So
you know, I'd say he's rival really by like Batman pretty much,
I think,
in terms of popularity.
So I am not interested in the MCU. And this is a weird meta thing. Maybe we'll get into the game theory of consuming media, because I'm not really interested in the MCU, and we've talked about that at length on this show.
We have a whole episode about this.
We did, and we should probably redo it, actually. I think the time might be ripe to do it, actually do that justice, because that was just kind of off the cuff years ago. But
You just kind of started recording one day and said, it's good enough for a podcast.
We had a topic, and we were like, no, let's talk about this.
That was a fun one to do.
It was, and we should, I mean, with real full research at our back, we might do, or with half-assed research at our back, we might even do a little bit better job.
Research is a very strong term.
I've seen, of the MCU, I don't know how many there are now, I believe it's in the 20s, I have seen about five. At the top of my head, I've seen, I think, five. I was early into Iron Man, Iron Man 2. I've seen Guardians of the Galaxy was a very fresh, that was a breath of fresh air. I remember I was spending summer in Mississippi. That was a fun one. I went twice. I haven't gone to a movie twice. I worked at a movie theater and I went to see Batman, The Dark Knight like 30 times because I would just, instead of going home, I would just watch it. Like, why not?
Yeah, that kind of became your personality for a little while.
Yeah, it did. But I was in high school. It's better than being goth. Said it, meant it.
Batman is just goth with a formality attached to it.
But I don't
Heath Ledger was as goth as it gets. His face is dripping in makeup. He's wearing an awkwardly fancy suit.
That is a dark point. I guess it is the Joker goth.
The guy got so lost in the character that he died as an indirect result of that. His behavior became so weird and isolationist, and is like, and now he's like super romanticized in a way that he really shouldn't be by the wrong people. I mean, that's as goth as it gets.
I saw this as a side quest here. I saw a take on TikTok that was like, Hollywood can't do anti-hero stories well because people just end up fantasizing about the anti-hero. Yep.
Anyway, yeah, really. I think the most recent version of that is probably like Homelander on The Boys, which is Amazon Prime thing. People are like, oh yeah, Homelander's awesome.
So I did want to say that back to the MCUs. I don't like ingesting them as film. I do like the clips and the analysis of the MCU cinematic universe on TikTok and YouTube. I like breakdowns of it. So I do understand the situation, and I think that's a really important thing to what we're talking about here, right? So the comics, I think Stan Lee, right, and Marvel, he wrote all of them. He invented these people. Different people own the rights to publish them. He probably gets royalties or whatever, and they own it.
When he was alive.
When he was alive. And his estate will get royalties for 70 years after his death. I think
so much money. The man was swimming in money.
Yes.
The only reason that he ever had to get the money out of the way was so that he could hang out with all the women. Yeah. Right. Stan Lee was a creative genius, and Jack Kirby was probably the other big guy. But
yep.
Yeah. They, yep. So, ton of royalties off these.
So things. Then They make it, but they agree to publish it, and the publisher gets a cut. That's the job of the publisher. Like, hey, we'll give you a platform in exchange for a huge portion of the intellectual property. I don't know the deals. I don't know. I didn't never negotiate those contracts. I'm not a lawyer. I don't understand that. But then whoever owns the rights to it, depending on the contract that Stan Lee has with whoever was publishing it, and again, it doesn't matter, they would then negotiate with who gets to make non-comic versions of it. And I mean TV shows, movies, figurines, etc. That's licensing. That's licensed out. You sign over your creative product for either a period of time or a number of finite products so that other people can operate your thing and do stuff with it. And that's what we're talking about today, because in the news, there are a number of things that have happened. Namely, the two things that I kind of want to get into, which is really interesting. Joe Rogan re-upped with Spotify, but not exclusively. They are paying him more money, but his shit will be on like other platforms, including YouTube, which is like a bananas thing for Spotify to do. Secondly, and the big one, Universal Music Group, the largest music publisher in the world, did not come to terms on a contract agreement with social media site TikTok. And as a result of that, UMG-owned music is not only not available, all past videos that had it on there have been muted. Now, if you're one of these creators, if you're an influencer and you've used Drake or Taylor Swift in one of your videos, you can simply edit it after the fact and give it a new sound. So I saw Sheryl Crow as one of these artists. She has started to see, and this is where licensing gets weird to me. And I don't know her deal with Universal Music Group, who puts the music out, but I do know that she's pissed about this enough to just start. She's starting to just like get a mic and sing acoustic versions for people to use in their videos. Like, she's just making music that goes out, because she gets, if anybody wants to know how people make money on TikTok, a lot of these creators, they make stuff, they do deals. The real money is in the sounds. If you make a sound that goes viral and they cross platform, those people get kickbacks forever and ever and ever. It's changed. If you have a sound that goes viral to the tune of 100 million videos being made with your sound, I don't know that you'll never have to work again, but it's a job essentially. So that's what's at stake here. So, did I get everything right with Marvel? See, this is what happens. Sony owns it and is being licensed to other organizations, including Disney, right? The MCU is a Disney thing now, right?
Yep. Marvel Studios is a subsidiary of Disney. That's why to watch all the Marvel stuff, you got to watch it on Disney Plus now. Years ago, it used to be that you could find, you know, like Avengers Endgame or whatever. Like the Avengers films were on Netflix or, you know, whatever streaming platform. And then Disney came out with its own, I think in like 2019 or so. And they moved all of the Marvel stuff onto that platform because they own the creative rights to it. Except they don't always have the Spider-Man stuff because that's owned by Sony and the character is licensed to Disney. I don't know what the legal details are there, but the concept is the same.
Yep.
A company pays another company for the creative rights to take advantage of whatever the creative property is. Under the terms of the agreement, they say, you know, you can't portray him this way or that way, or, you know, you can't do this or that with him. But it's really just like a rent a property for the most part.
Yeah.
And that's, so you're saying that's what happens with this
yep.
Universal Music Group and TikTok.
Yeah. So I was an early adopter of TikTok, and then I made the smartest decision of my life to just delete the app and be like, oh, that's dumb.
Good call. wise decision.
I could on be that an influence. One. I was early adopter, like 2018, 2017, like early. And, I remember when I got back on the app in 2019, about, I want to say 6 months before the pandemic really happened, I noticed that all of a sudden there were music and sounds happening. That was kind of when sounds really became part of the deal. Like, oh, people are just making highlights to this music I've never heard before, and that they're using it. I'm like, well, that, I know how the law works. I don't know if there have been legal changes, but when I was in school and learning media law, I learned that essentially you have 30 seconds for free. And then at 30 seconds, you've crossed the line. And I know that for songs, it might be a percentage of the time. But if we wanted to use a song from Spotify, because we published this podcast through Spotify will give us a clip of one of millions of songs for 30 seconds. And then we can't. And then the artist would get to have money. We would be stealing their thing. So TikTok had this. And I was like, that's amazing. Like, oh, well, this has to be a deal. This is the official song. It has to be a deal. And then people will make remixes. Well, those, you know, Universal Music Group, they would have like AI and people monitoring that so that they would get a kickback. So they would have these songs. There was an agreement in place between Universal Music Group, which owns Taylor Swift, which is a big one, of course, but Drake and a bunch of others. I mean, I guess I could share my screen and see all of these people, but that deal expired. And as a result of that, all of their catalog has been pulled and every video that they have has been muted. Now, the game theory thing here is the negotiations of who benefits more from this relationship and who has the authority to kind of play hardball. And we're seeing this licensing authority hardball game being played by people all over the place, and it gets into a deeper and more annoying thing to me, which is that who owns something and who really has the authority to like decide which portion of a thing they own. For example, and I want to circle back to this, remind me, when you buy a movie,
we'll put a pin in it. We'll put it in the parking lot for later on, so when we're checking for any last alibis, we can discuss it.
When you buy a movie on something like Amazon Prime or Google TV or Apple TV, you don't own it. And if they...
Yeah, you basically have rented the right to use it for an extended period. I mean, the leap to get to there is not really very far from where we're at. I mean, if you think about it like a video rental store, you're not buying the VHS tape that your favorite movie is on. You're renting it out for a certain period of time, and you got to return it. Well, the same is true for if you rent something on Amazon or YouTube or, you know, wherever you rent your movies from. And even if you buy that, you're not purchasing the film.
Yep.
You're purchasing the right to view that film for a certain period of time within the terms of the agreement. And the price point is the price point. Except the only difference now is instead of having to return a VHS tape or send it back in the mail or whatever, now you just lose access to the electrons that are floating around in whatever server or are downloaded to your machine. Like you lose the opportunity to consume the content that's coded onto those files. And the physical object that you have is just electronics that are working in your computer. So it's not... It conceptually, it feels like it's kind of a different thing, but really it's the same as renting a video for a certain period of time. And those of us who are over the age of like 12 remember well what it was like to go to Blockbuster. Is that, by the way, is that one Blockbuster still opening? Is there still like the last Blockbuster?
The one in Oregon, I think it's still owning and operating, and they have the keys to the official Twitter account, which is just amazing.
Just crazy. Absolutely crazy.
I know.
But so, I'm impressed. Yeah. The thing that stands out to me with this is, so I'm taking a look now. Universal wrote this open letter to the songwriting community. It says why we must call timeout on TikTok. So they describe what happened. They said, you know, their agreement with TikTok, by which they have a set contract that allows for the fair use of music that's created by artists that are whose property or whose creative property is owned by UMG. That deal that TikTok can use those sounds expired on January 31st, 2024. So here we are about a week after that has expired. And I don't know if there are plans to renegotiate or renew, but that platform no longer has access to UMG properties because of the contract expiration. And in this letter, UMG says, we've been pressing TikTok on three critical issues. So the issues that allegedly, or you know, whatever the publicist team came up with, they're saying that the sticking points are appropriate compensation for our artists and songwriters.
Yep.
Okay, that's one. Two is protecting human artists from the harmful effects of AI. Mm. Now, that one's come up a little bit more recently, especially with certain visuals. And those of you who spend any time online will know what I'm alluding to here. Mm-hmm. So that's two. And three is online safety for TikTok's users. Now, that one, that last one, I feel like is a stretch. I don't know what UMG thinks they're doing. Just throw that in there to
make it we care about the safety of our users. Like, bullshit.
Well, to me, that reads like a public relations thing where like, well, people digest things in threes. And if there is a third issue, then it'll kind of round
like
it out.
Everything is like, the two big things that you hear are our thoughts are with them and we take these things very seriously. Like, oh, do you?
Yeah, I mean that last one. UMG doesn't care how safe online users are. That doesn't really matter to them. What matters is compensation. That's the whole point of licensing agreements, and that's why the company that owns the creative rights to what artists are producing, that's why that company exists, so that they can profit off of that. And it's a mutually beneficial relationship a lot of times, because if there's a large company that's distributing and allowing people to purchase versions of whatever the artists create, well, then the artists can get that money in a way that they might not be able to if they didn't have access to a larger market. And it's kind of the same reason that like pawn shops can sell people's goods for higher value than they're willing to pay for them. It's because they have access to the market of buyers. You know, it's hard for somebody who owns like a valuable antique to be able to sell that and get the most value out of it, where a pawn shop is an established thing. So they have customers coming to them who are looking for that sort of thing. So they pay the owner of the antique more money than the owner had beforehand. But the store is able to remain profitable because they can make more money than the person who's selling the antique would have. So they kind of gain from that purchase.
Yes.
Same story with the reason UMG and those companies exist. So their primary focus here is on compensation, but the negotiating power, it's really interesting how they're able to kind of jockey with this platform through which a lot, an increasing proportion of consumers are getting access to music that is owned by the company.
Yeah, so I think that Universal's concerns are valid, but I think that, I don't know, I'm not in the room, obviously, and neither are you. My gut feeling is that this is like everything else in America. This is about money. They want more money for themselves. And that's, I mean, a really basic understanding of this entire situation. However, when you look at what each party stands to gain and lose, I am firmly of the opinion that TikTok has a significantly stronger hold here, and that the United States music industry, or the English-speaking music industry, American companies like UMG, they really have a difficult time kind of digesting that this isn't the way that things were when, you know, Led Zeppelin was at Woodstock, or I don't think they ever went to Woodstock. It's not like that anymore. And I think that artists benefit a lot. Like I mean, mental health aside, I've had a difficult time discovering new music in the last 10 years. It's just not a thing that's been happening for me. I don't feel like I have the patience to have to listen to a song like 3 or 4 times. I just don't do it. But if I am on TikTok and I hear a song 5 or 6 times, TikTok has been over 90% of my discovery of new music in the last 2 or 3 years. And it's been really great for me. It's been exciting. I'm like, oh yeah. Like I learned about a great example of an artist that went from like a lot of potential in his local area to incredibly popular Grammy nominee is Noah Kahan with Stick Season and a number of other things. He's featured with other A-list people like Casey Musgraves and Post Malone. This person rose to power because of TikTok and covers of his song. Now his songs have been completely removed and you're like, okay, well, does UMG benefit from having random new people discovered as a result of this insane platform? Or does UMG and kind of trickle down, their artists deserve more money for all these people making it so popular? And it boils down to the exact same thing that we're seeing with Marvel Comics. It's the exact same thing we're seeing with movies, and specifically which shows are on which streaming platform. In point blank period, Disney's trying to show for its stakeholders how many subscribers they have from Disney Plus, but their shit isn't getting viewed as much because it's not on Netflix, period. Like, it just, I mean, that's part of the deal here. So the decision for UMG is, are we going to lose value long term by not just sucking up and not getting as much from TikTok? And because TikTok's gamble is, nobody gives a shit about your songs. They were here before, they'll be here after.
Yeah, so let's look at what UMG said actually about this compensation component of it. So in this open letter, they say, with respect to the issue of artist and songwriter compensation, TikTok proposed paying our artists and songwriters at a rate that is a fraction of the rate similarly situated for social media platforms, like that other social media platforms pay. So they're basically saying, look, compared to YouTube, compared to Facebook, compared to other Facebook properties like Instagram or WhatsApp, TikTok wants to pay artists a significantly smaller proportion. So what it sounds like to me is that they're basically just offering a smaller rate of compensation to UMG, and UMG saying, well, our cut's always going to be our cut. So the fact that there's less here left over for the artists means that the artists are going to be paid a lower rate. Mm-hmm. Okay, fine. That is what it is. But then they try to back up this argument that TikTok isn't paying very much by saying, as an indication of how little TikTok compensates artists and songwriters, despite its massive and growing user base, rapidly rising advertising revenue, and increasing reliance on music-based content, so there you go, they rely on the sounds, as you said earlier, TikTok accounts for only about 1% of our total revenue. So it's an interesting thing that social media is becoming a larger driving force, at least in the zeitgeist, or like it seems that that's how people discover new music. And you know, there's something to be said for the fact that like major artists like Elton John doesn't need TikTok to continue having people listen to, discover, and pay for his music. Taylor Swift is the most recognizable celebrity in the world right now. Mm-hmm. And it's on the basis of her incredible, prodigious music production capability for which people are willing to pay an arm and a leg to have access to. She doesn't need TikTok. No. But there are some other artists, like smaller artists, they kind of do rely on that. So rapper JID is a UMG rapper. Sure. So this is an article according to Bloomberg. Jewel Wicker is writing about this and giving an example of somebody who might need or could benefit from more exposure on a platform like TikTok. So JID, a successful top artist with an avid fan base, he's got Grammy nominations, got a top 5 collab. And so the surround sound challenge was a social media phenomenon on TikTok. And that basically was like fans started taping their phones to the ceilings and dancing to it. Mm-hmm. So this surround sound challenge is like this kind of thing that users can participate in, and it drives more consumption of JID's song. And so with that challenge, with that push, the popularity of the song got so high that it moved it up to number 40 on the top 100 charts. So it actually is like, whether TikTok does or doesn't account for some percentage of UMG's revenue, what it does is drives the artist's productions higher and higher.
Yes.
And even if that's not necessarily a huge cut for UMG's revenue, that makes a big difference to the artist.
Yeah.
The artists, you know, with one exception, Taylor Swift, they don't have as much money as this large corporation, and their way of doing business has to be different because they don't get to negotiate their rights with individual platforms because they're signed by UMG. Yeah. So with the loss of access to platforms like TikTok that can increase their popularity and improve the rates with which their music is consumed and ostensibly improve their own like financial compensation, they stand to lose from the fact that this deal expired a week ago, and I don't know if it's going to get renewed.
Yeah, there have been, in my searches and things, I don't think that there doesn't seem to be a big fire for making this happen anytime soon. And I think that that's like a lot of this. Taylor Swift comes to mind. Her song Anti-Hero said, I have this thing where something, something, something. And then it became, I have this thing was the quote that people were making for their videos. And they would make it about their cat or about their mental illness or whatever that they made it their thing. Right. And it's a quote from one of her songs.
Sure.
That is a Universal Music Group property, essentially. I mean, Taylor gets money every time people play that, but they get access to that. So on one hand, there is a section of TikTok that is all about promoting artists before the sound of the music, but there is another one. Noah Kahan is a great example. He's got a song called Homesick, where one of the chorus lines is, I'm mean because I grew up in New England. So it was a bunch of New Englanders just telling all their stories of the times they were assholes. And it was like, I'm mean because I grew up in New England. It's like that kind of trend. It's an enjoyable camaraderie-based social media experience, but it's based on this song that he came through. So the marketing thing is completely true. Halsey, the I think multi-platinum recording artist Halsey, she had TikToks kind of exposing how much she hated her record label, because record labels were, what they were doing was making artists wait for a viral moment to release a song. Like they would kind of sneak it out there, and if it went viral, then they would release the single so that they would line up with the marketing. There, Lizzo had a song that bombed and it wasn't popular, and it was released as a single and nobody liked it, and then they kept dicking with it on TikTok and it came back out and it was one of her biggest hits because of the TikTok thing. So these music organizations, it's not lost on them what it means to go viral, either because the song is good or because it's a trend. Like that is insanely important. So I see this artist, Cody Fry, and he's cited in Wall Street Journal, did a deep dive exactly about what this means. And it's a really great article. Alyssa Luke Pat, Julia Munslow, and Joseph D. Avila. Cody Fry, and this is kind of how I knew this might be an episode we want to do, was talking about how he had just in the last 30 days got a song that had got some traction. It was going incredibly viral in China, which is like the dream because of the amount of consumption that can go over there. And if it does well in any part of Eastern Asia, maybe it'll trickle into other parts of Eastern Asia, then hop the pond and here you are. And TikTok, one thing, as I've dabbled in being a social media creator, they have insanely robust data about the way your stuff's being consumed. So if you make stuff, you know a lot, and it's great. That's a really powerful tool. And he's like, I'm watching this thing, it's going up and up and up and up. It's a big moment for me. I've been trying to quote unquote make it, and then it gets pulled, and then, like, you know, it's dead. Then nobody's watching these videos anymore. Like that guy, it means a lot to him. So talk about Noah Kahan. He's at the Grammys, man. And I'm sure maybe he gets there without TikTok, but does he go from being a small venue artist to selling out enormous venues? I don't know. I don't think so. I who's to say? But the promotional power of TikTok to me is so important that if their argument is that, like, you need us more than we need you, and Universal Music Group's like, well, then pay more. I don't, like, it seems to be a weird petty standoff to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And you know, when it comes to artist protection, their creative ability, I mean, is that's ultimately the marketable thing. And so right. if they're creative, they're able to produce something that's of value, that's great. But there's another angle to this that goes beyond just like negotiations for compensation and access to large platforms that can get their performances out there and have this kind of quote unquote viral moment that's so important with the way that people consume media nowadays. And that is the other concern that UMG brought to the table, which is AI. So the basic kind of problem with generative AI is that instead of putting it to work doing a lot of kind of menial tasks that human beings have tried to like kind of automate and have mostly successfully automated over the years, like manual labor stuff that people need to survive. We've put it to work doing really the most human stuff that you can, which is creating and expressing and doing that in visual ways and doing that in audio ways and stuff. And I think that's a legitimate concern. You know, as an AI truther, I don't think that's really real. It's not really intelligence. It's a generative program. Like chatbots have been around for forever. And but regardless, Gen AI is a real it's a real asset for companies that are trying to get people to consume more media, because you don't really have to pay an AI program to create a 15-second soundbite or a 15-second visual to go along with some soundbite. And oh, by the way, as everyone knows, AI models are they're dependent on the data sets that are fed to them. Well, if you have access to an artist's entire oeuvre of work, you can feed that into the machine. And it'll, with the quality of Gen AI bots these days, you can create a kind of a convincing replica of that. Or you can say like, all right, well, what if Harry S. Truman was singing some album or some song from like 1989? Or like do the theme song to The Sopranos, but do it in the Garfield voice actor voice from whatever. And if you have access to that stuff, if you have access to those licensed programs, you can kind of create this stuff. And so UMG in their letter is also kind of complaining about that. They say TikTok is allowing the platform to be flooded with AI-generated recordings, as well as developing tools to enable, promote, and encourage AI music creation on the platform itself. So they're allowing, like, the average person to use AI stuff to kind of feed into a machine and create AI TikToks. And with how brain dead TikTok has already successfully made everybody, for some reason, that quality that stuff doesn't have to be high quality to be interesting and get people's eyeballs on the app.
For sure.
Then their complaint continues. Then TikTok demands contractual right, which would allow this content, this AI-generated content, to massively dilute the royalty pool for human artists in a move that is nothing short of sponsoring artist replacement by AI. So that one, I think that's a legitimate complaint.
Yeah, I agree.
A real thing.
I've heard.
So it's a rare confluence of interest between like, okay, the artists are the asset for Universal Music Group. Universal Music Group makes a deal to allow the artists to become profitable in exchange for a cut of their money. Okay, fine. But it hurts both the artists and this large company that's negotiating a contract with each artist to have some other technology-based, non-royalty-earning replacement for the creative asset that the artists bring to the table. So that's a real problem. And frankly, I think it's a problem for consumption just based on the way that social media trends are going. We can talk about that here in a second.
Yeah.
But the AI angle really hurts pretty much everybody except for the company who makes its money based on small views and advertising revenue rather than the music or actual creative output.
Yes. So I think, and I have seen generative AI make songs, and like, here's, I asked AI to write a Taylor Swift song and here's what it came up with. You're like, oh, that's really fascinating and really good. Are we in a weird spiral that's going to lead us back into the prioritization of palpable or confirmable experiences, right? And how profound is our Descartes joke from last time, I think, therefore I am, right? Or what is real? Like, what is a simulation? So if you're on the internet and you hear something, you're like, at a certain point, I simply can't believe it's true unless I'm physically there. Or as we were talking about, and here's a nice little callback up to actually owning a movie. Like, we have a box of DVDs. The wife's a big fan of Sex and the City. She has Mad Men and some other stuff. You're like, well, you can watch it on TV, but like, you can't. If they pull the license from Apple TV and you pay $20 for it, it doesn't matter if you pay $20. You won't be refunded. You just gave Apple $20 and you don't own anything. It doesn't matter at all in any way. Are we going to reprioritize going to concerts? I have vinyl records. That was a nostalgia play. But now I'm like, well, I have the music. I know what's real. I know what's not real. Are we going to need to do that at some point to combat this AI thing? And I will also say, from a game theory standpoint, I don't know if this is game theory and I don't know what it is. I just know that from covering the news and studying the news, negotiations that have one priority do substantially better than negotiations that have a laundry list of stuff. So like, if you go, because then at that point you're in a game, you're like, well, I'll give you this, I'll give you that. If UMG is like, curtail this AI shit or you're not getting our stuff, I imagine it would be very simple to put the ball in TikTok's court. But if you have a list of things that you're upset about and then TikTok has their list of things, you can be like, oh, well, this is a convoluted, aggressive issue. Remember Occupy Wall Street? they started out with one goal, and then enough voices got in there that it became like 30 goals. And you're like, well, if you had just kept the one goal, I think you may have accomplished it, but there's no organization. So if TikTok came out and just said, hey, no more AI, figure out the AI thing right now. Do it right now. And then I think that everyone would be more upset with TikTok. They'd be like, oh, you know what? That's a good point. Figure this out. Give money to Taylor Swift, not to the dude who wrote the ChatGPT code.
I could be wrong about this, but you can kind of find this out there in the ether on the internet. Allegedly, there was this there's this like declassified kind of CIA guide for how to be disruptive as like a foreign plant in like bureaucracy. Like if you get recruited as an agent and you work in a foreign government, or you like you secretly like clandestinely go into some foreign government or whatever, there was like a how-to guide on how to be really disruptive to that organization's functioning. And they recommended stuff like when you're in meetings with people, make sure that everybody's voice gets heard at every meeting, no matter how menial the thing is. Mm-hmm. Focus really intently on like the process instead of the substance or whatever. Be really, really like a stickler for small details. Always raise additional points when you feel like things are getting wrapped up. And I feel like it included something to the effect of try to make things about more than one thing. Yeah. Like you're so much less productive when you dilute the messaging with whatever else. And so like in everything from contract negotiations to political movements to like task-based stuff in your house, if you try to make everything about everything, then you don't really get anywhere. You think about a lot of stuff and you have a lot of stuff in your mind all the time, but it's not really fruitful thought. It's not really fruitful engagement of effort. And so with this contract negotiation, I don't know how comprehensive the agreement is. I know what Universal is talking about. They've got these kind of 3 points here. Mm-hmm. But beyond that rhetorical construction that was meant for the public to consume, I don't really know exactly how detailed this contract is and whether it covers all of AI stuff or whether it's a subset or whether it covers all of artist compensation stuff or whether there are subsets. I don't really know. But I tend to agree with you. I mean, from a negotiation standpoint, it seems to me much more productive to focus on specific issues. And that's why like really intense special interest groups and lobbyists, that's why they're the ones who are getting most of what they want done with Congress, because they can focus on one thing at one time, mm-hmm. instead of having these gigantic protests where like there's a lot of energy and there's a lot of fervor and there's a lot of people involved, but they don't really accomplish much in terms of like policy change or attitude shifts in their favor, because they kind of try to be about everything. Like big tent movements are really, they feel good, and for historical reasons, like some of them really succeed, some of them don't. But at the end of the day, like when it comes to gaming out a scenario, I think it's much more in your favor to have a tight focus on specific sets of issues, and then you can make tangible progress. And I don't know, maybe you will on other areas, maybe you won't. But I agree with you. I think it's better to have a more focused approach here.
And like we're seeing that here, and I think we'll get into some social media conversation before we wrap this up, because I think TikTok is under fire recently for something that has nothing to do with Universal Music Group. It's that The Verge, I heard this on a podcast in The Verge, maybe it was a Recode, Decode, I don't know which one. They were doing an interview, and the guy was like, compared to YouTube and Reels, YouTube Shorts and Reels, which are kind of at least the platform competitors of TikTok, the vertical-oriented phone and whatnot, they have more ads and partnership deals per minute and per hour than YouTube and Instagram by a lot. And so there have been a lot of people that are like TikTok shop. TikTok has been dabbling and trying to compete with every major tech company. And I think that's going to be what ends up biting them in the foot. They have a shop now. Like everyone's trying to screw with Amazon, and I don't know about that. And now they're doing music, because you can get TikTok to the point where they're longer videos. They're going to try to dabble in music and podcasts, like their own app, like Apple Music and Spotify and stuff. So they're coming at a lot of people, but the shop thing has really, really pissed people off. One of the cool things about TikTok is the earnestness. As a user and an early adopter of the use of it, I really like when accounts that have fewer than 1,000 or 10,000 followers have viral videos, but then they keep making this content and then they go, whenever I see a viral video, I'm like, oh, this person's a professional. The more followers they have, the more I think like this could be bullshit, or they're making it up, or they don't really feel this way. And as a result of that, it loses its focus. And you combine that with the insane amount of ads and TikTok, they're promoting stuff at their own shop, and like, okay, well, now it's getting inundated with garbage, and you could become bot filled horror zone anytime. I know that anonymous apps have this problem where they're just a bunch of like pedophiles and bots, like old apps like Yik Yak in college. When it started out, it was cool. Then it gets inundated and it's not monetized correctly and it's not kept on point, and then it gets broken. Like Facebook right now, I would say, is broken. I mean, it's kind of like that fake news and a certain demographic, and it's broken. Twitter is next. I mean, Twitter is happening now. The bots are out of control, and TikTok comments are, if you go to TikTok comments and see the amount of bots that are commenting first and stuff, it's wild. So this is not, it's more of a tenuous situation for TikTok than you think. You've got to tend your own garden. And I think they're kind of trying to dabble into shit that's not none of their business, like Amazon and Spotify. That's my take.
Well, I think what you're describing gets at really a foundational shift in the way that social media, or I guess the role that social media plays in people's day-to-day lives. I mean, if you remember back to like 2004, Facebook kind of comes out, like the anniversary of it was actually a few days ago. So we're recording this in early February. Mm-hmm. February 4th, 2004, Mark Zuckerberg launches the Facebook.com. So this is a 20-year-old platform, and it back then it was competing with sites like Friendster and MySpace. They don't exist anymore. But kind of the deal with those, well, actually, does MySpace exist? I don't care. It doesn't matter. It's not one of the big companies. But with how prominent social media was in those days for people being able to express themselves and participate in larger conversations, that was kind of the main function. In fact, you know, Zuckerberg and some of these other big executives called social media the new digital town square. Whereas, like, you know, in ancient times and through medieval civilizations, like the town square was where people went to go get news and engage in commerce, and that was, you know, there was a reason, like in medieval Europe, like churches were at the center of the town because that's where people went for sure. A large part of their social interaction, as well as their kind of religious obligations and political obligations and stuff. And so now social media in the early 2000s and 2010s was like this town square online where people could do that right from the comfort of their own home. Yep. The emphasis used to be on doing stuff like sharing photos and like the revolution being able to share videos of yourself or to share music like on MySpace. Say, hey, this is what I'm listening to. My personality is kind of tied to these songs.
Or the toxic shit of your top four or top eight friends.
Your top friends. Yes, the drama that was created with that. And then sharing status updates. And Twitter's kind of big hook for that. Of course, Twitter came out in 2006. Their big thing was like, well, you know, forget the news or forget the links or whatever, forget the images, forget the videos. People just want status updates. They don't want to hear about whatever. They want to hear about, okay, I'm doing this thing right now. So it was 140 characters of just my self-expression. Well, over time, all of those things have kind of shifted. It's social media now, and I'm looking at this. The Economist this week ran this interesting briefing on social media.
Nice.
It's a big, extensive thing. Yeah, classic edition here, not online. But The Economist ran this big thing on social media, and they said, okay, that early iteration of it has shifted now, and TikTok really was probably like the boulder carrying the momentum that started the rock slide into this new form of engagement with social media, which is primarily consumption driven. Mm-hmm. So whereas before, the draw to social media is I can now participate and express myself and share these things about myself and communicate with others. Now it's like I go to this platform for entertainment, to smooth my brain, to watch videos. That's more engaging to me than sharing my stories.
Sure.
And you know, you can see that with like young people, like people don't really post the same kind of stuff now that they did 20 years ago
when
people
were
younger.
And I think that I learned that in social media literacy in college, obviously media studies. You don't, unless you're there to create, you don't gain anything from posting. And unless your game is tight and you're private and your privacy is, you can kind of only hurt yourself. And I think that that's an intuitive thing for Generation Z, quote unquote, and Gen Alpha, is that like just being online. So unless you're going to announce yourself as a creator to create things that are meant to be consumed, like I am a creator of content, unless you're doing that, you're only putting yourself at risk or kind of sharing. I sort of have used Instagram, and you follow me on Instagram. I'm really good at posting funny little things as stories, and I know that I am, but I do it just for my like 700 followers to be like, this is kind of what I'm thinking about today, or oh, I saw that's weird. Just stuff I'd bring up to you. But I don't want to.
But you do delineate yourself as a nouveau boomer, aka a millennial, when you do that, because that's not really something that people do as much anymore. Now I do want to. So I'm going to hit you with some facts from this excellent analysis from The Economist. Well, so first I do want to mention like there were real social movements that affected people's actual day to day lives that came out of social media, and the examples they list here are the Me Too movement that was entirely online, and it generated real political and real social attitude shifts. I mean,
no question.
There was like a truly kind of important moment in American society where it's like there's this reckoning with this very real set of problems that mostly stems from like abusive power structures in the workplace, of which women are, you know, primarily targeted and are at the biggest disadvantage. So this hashtag Me Too, that was a big deal. That was a real thing that started online and has produced positive change. Similarly, hashtag Black Lives Matter, another major social movement that was generated in large part online. That one was more interesting because it happened during the pandemic, so it was almost necessarily online until that momentum got so big and so large that it convinced people to say, you know what, there are bigger things at play here than these pandemic restrictions, so I'm going to go out and I'm going to protest in whatever form that takes, or I'm going to gather and participate in this social event. So that was an online thing that became real. The Arab Spring, another example, in 2011, that was in an information-repressed environment, the online ecosystem actually produced a way for this kind of social movement, for this liberation and really truly democracy to thrive. Unfortunately, also the Capitol riot is an example of the way that this has like actually affected real day-to-day life. But let me hit you with some facts and figures here. So first of all, Facebook is the biggest social media platform. It's got 3 billion people, which is about 60% of everybody that uses the entire internet. You know, 3 billion people use it a month, which is just absolutely crazy. Also, people's time spent using social media has increased. So total time spent using social apps on Android devices has risen by 42% since 2020. So just a ton amount of time. 2.3 trillion hours last year in 2023. That's how much time people spent on social media apps on Android. And by the way, Android devices are 70% of the world's phones. So that's just a ton of people sitting there and just kind of consuming this stuff. Also, consider, like you kind of mentioned this earlier with like the vertical short form video format. Vine was the progenitor of that, RIP to a real one, created some fun online cultural moments. But since TikTok launched in 2017 and had this kind of like, oh, I can just easily watch these videos where anybody can create them and I can hear cool music and do whatever else. Since then, Meta added its video feature, Reels. That was that came after TikTok. Yep. Pinterest had one. It was called Watch. Snapchat has something called Spotlight. YouTube Shorts came about. And then finally, Elon Musk renamed Twitter X like a Hero fool.
King.
And he now claims it's a video first program.
Yeah, I mean, it has it. If you watch videos and you scroll up, it'll start to do the vertical scroll. Yeah. I wish I could veto that on my phone.
Truly. But so the point is that social media has shifted from an online production, self-expression, social participation thing. And it used to be like really network-based. And that's when we could get into like the topology of like your friends are always more popular than you. That was a fun thing to talk about. And those network dynamics into kind of just like a pipeline where people can just latch on like a, you know, like one of those sucker fish and passively consume content that's kind of shoved down their throat at increasingly chaotic and high volume intervals and detach whenever they want to. It's more about entertainment in the way that like television sets replaced social capital throughout the 80s and 90s. So people like pretty much moved to the suburbs and started watching TV. Well, now the TV set is in your hand. And instead of engaging and doing productive stuff, people just kind of sit at home and scroll through Reels and watch hundreds of TikToks. And it's not great, I think, for a social trend, but that is how people consume media anymore. And that's just the way things are. And TikTok was a really important part of that in this new social media ecosystem.
Yeah. And I think this dies with people getting bored. You know, I think that's kind of where I'm at. Like, I really want to watch TV and movies a lot. And I find myself being like, I don't know, just kind of bored. And I think that's where we're headed. Eventually, the only people that are posting are kind of not real people, and the versions of themselves that are putting online are fake, then I think that we're in a spot where it's not going to matter and people are just not going to consume it anymore. And they're doing, no disrespect to Marvel, exactly what Marvel did to its fans, which is like, let's just do it until you are completely sick of it. And not do it very well anymore and just half-ass and just throw out more content against the wall.
Well, the strategy then is to do it using a generative AI bot. So yeah. Now, like, the, you know, bots online have been a problem on social media forever, but now they can do things that sound a little bit more cohesive, like human sentences. They sound a little bit more convincing in their videos. The art is a little bit more realistic. And so then you don't need to really compensate people who go online and create stuff, because when everybody's passively consuming, the best way is to just have a machine that churns out the stuff that they're consuming.
And I think that we're going to have to do an episode on AI content soon, because Sports Illustrated just got caught doing that. They have their own licensing problems. So they got caught doing it.
Gross.
Remember Sports Illustrated used to be reputable? Better. And now the poor fools think it's still like sports journalism. It's just, I don't know what it is anymore.
I'm going to go dig up some old Barry Sanders highlights to feel better about myself.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember Time Magazine? That used to be a thing that people cared about.
Shout outs to Time. Mm-hmm.